you. We do have time. We have 5 minutes, and we can even maybe go 5 minutes after. Questions, observations, comments, please.
Would it be accurate if I were to have understood what you said tonight?
I couldn't quite hear.
I said, would it be accurate if I were to understand what you said tonight?
Yes.
As a description of what is perhaps the highest potential of what it means to be a human being?
I do believe that is a correct statement.
So, then what interests me in what I heard you say tonight is, what would happen to the earth? Would there be gardens? Would there be cities? Would there be nations? Would there be science? Would there be a need for any of that? Well, behind that, what my question is, another kind of doing comes out of that way of being. How do you imagine that kind of doing?
Mm-hmm. Boy, now we'll have our second lecture for tonight. Thank you for an immensely rich question, which I have to give a very concise answer. A historical fact that I think has been true, as far as I know, everywhere, where Christianity is spread, everywhere where Buddhism is spread, Hinduism, and so forth, the great contemplative traditions of the world, is that at any given point in history, in any culture that is a host for these great contemplative traditions, it has always been historically a small minority of even the devout Christians, Buddhists, Hindus, and so forth, a small minority that devote themselves wholeheartedly, single-pointedly, and for a lifetime to contemplative inquiry. It's always a small minority. Now, that's history. Will that be the case in the future, or could it turn it into a mass movement where, you know, a very significant portion of the population did so? But judging by all the history we have so far, recorded history, it's always been a small minority. But even if it's a small minority, like 1%, as in the case of Tibet, that was the most contemplative culture that I've ever heard of, with 6 million people and 6,000 monasteries. So one monastery per 1,000 people, some of the monasteries having 10,000 monks, others being little hermitages with a half dozen monks, but 6,000 for 6 million people. And one out of every 5 men, a monk, and a little bit lower proportion of women who are nuns. So it was an extraordinarily contemplative, that is spiritual, that is a broad base of spirituality being an extremely high priority for the society as a whole. Not to say, of course, that there weren't bad people there. People are people. But people devoted monastically by their whole lifestyle to spiritual practice and study and so forth. And then among these contemplatives, some monastics, many not monastic, but people who are then utterly devoted to contemplative inquiry, it was probably less than 1%, I think almost certainly less than 1% of people really deeply devoted to the contemplative. At the same time, even though it was a minute percentage, maybe 0.1%, something like that, or even maybe something of that order, nevertheless, I think the impact on the society was very, very deep and very, very broad. I mean, I think it transmuted that whole society. And so the impact was enormous. And we'll find this in other cases, too, throughout history. The whole region of Mount Athos, there are periods in the Christian tradition, the Desert Fathers, and in the Taoist tradition, and Hinduism, and so forth. So where that has happened, priorities shift, not only for this very, very few who are totally dedicated, but it has a kind of a ripple effect to shift people's priorities out way beyond the meditative hermitage here and there, shifts priorities to a very large extent. So I think that's the top-down influence. And so when the people that we regard as our icons, whether they're politicians, whether they're movie stars, they're singers, they're philosophers, they're scientists, but the icons that people, many, many people look up to, the icons, which are usually very, very few, a small percentage of the population as a whole, the icons for any given society do tend to have a very, very large impact on the society as a whole. And in Tibet, I think it's safe to say that to a very large extent, I'm just picking on this as a contemplative culture, to a very large extent, the icons, the people that the whole society looked up to and say, there's our ideal, the embodiment of our ideal, the vast majority of them were contemplatives. And nowadays for the Tibetan people, there's one icon above all icons. It's the Dalai Lama. You know, there's just no one of his stature that all Tibetans look, I mean, with virtually no exception, way beyond 99%, they look upon him, there's the icon, there's the person we want to emulate. He embodies what we hold most dear, of greatest value. And what is that? It's the contemplative ideals of compassion, of wisdom, of ethics, of kindness, So I think that's where the real impact has been historically. Now, are we coming to some kind of a breaking point where this could actually turn into a cascade effect or an avalanche effect, that this would then start to take on a much greater magnitude of people east and west devoting themselves to contemplative practice? And what kind of impact would that have on the planet, on society, on universities, on industry, on the way we impact our ecosphere? Well, I would certainly love to see that experiment take place. But in the meantime, if there can even be a very small number of people utterly devoted to the contemplative, I think that alone, historically speaking, we can count on it. That will have a very significant impact. And that is clearly within the realm of possibility because it's happened already. So with the Santa Barbara Institute, that really is my most cherished heart desire. It's not that I'll just give a lot more lectures and lead week-long retreats, which I'm doing already, but I, working with a whole fellowship of other people, including other teachers, that we create an environment where we can offer the opportunities, the facilities at very low cost, or just give scholarships for people to devote themselves, like the monks in Mount Athos, the yogis in Tibet, the yogis in Rishikesh in northern India, and so forth, to years or even decades of very sustained, absolutely focused contemplative inquiry. And let it be a tiny number, that's fine. The repercussions may be magnificent. So that's something doable. That's something I'm hoping to see become realized within 5 years, 10 years. Yeah. It's a magnificent question. Maybe one other? We'll call it a night. Yes, please.
Do you have any comment on the book Jesus Lived in India, which supposedly accounts for a period of his life otherwise unaccounted for and refers to a text in the library at Hemis, which supposedly was also seen by some Westerners earlier about his presence there and the coming into Christianity of some things Buddhist thereby?
Right. I'm not sure I've seen that particular book, but I knew everything you're saying is familiar to me, including the monastery in Hemis. And when I was living in India about 30 years ago, there came into my hands what was allegedly an English translation of this lost text that was the life of Isa. Of Isa, which then is the form of Jesus, name of Jesus, that as a young man, probably maybe a young adolescent, left home, traveled east, made his way to Ladakh, studied under great masters, became an extremely accomplished person himself, displayed miracles and so forth, and when he had finished his training, then headed back home. I read that translation, and by that time I was fluent in Tibetan, and I couldn't for the life of me translate what I was reading in English back into Tibetan. Just the language was so completely alien to any Buddhist concepts or ways of phrasing anything that it made me think, well, whatever language it came from, and they said it came from Tibetan, I couldn't even imagine how that could be the case. Just because nothing corresponded to anything I'd studied in Buddhism or even the Tibetan language. So that made me somewhat suspect. And of course, the fact that the text has simply vanished, that makes also, it makes one's, arouses some skepticism. I have read a number of accounts of this hypothesis. In principle, I'd have to say, I find it quite feasible. The Jews themselves, historically, going way back before the time of Jesus, they were intensely interested in history and in personal narrative. We know the story of David. We know the story of prophet after prophet after prophet. They were, perhaps more than any other culture on the planet, with possible exception of the Chinese, intensely interested in history, right? They were the chosen people, and they were chronicling the trajectory of God's own people through time. Now, other cultures are not like that. Indians really didn't care squat about history. Really, the history is terrible. The Tibetans have some, but it's not that good. But the Jews really were keen. So to have a person within the Jewish culture and the accounts written by Jews, even Paul, of course, very Hellenized, but he was a Jew. They were all Jews. These people had been steeped in historicity. And they give the account of his birth. They give account of his childhood. He's traveled to Egypt. He came back. The child, then the prodigies, you know, speaking with the scribes and the rabbis in the temple and showing his great insight and so forth, blowing their minds at the age of, what, 12 or something like that. All of that very clear. And then this great big gaping hole with nothing. And then suddenly he crops up. He seeks out John the Baptist. He's baptized. You know, after he's been in the desert, John the Baptist, and then John the Baptist baptizes him, and then he sets out on his mission, everything chronicled up to his crucifixion, his resurrection, and his resurrection. I mean, so clear, you know, so much detail, and this great big gap. At least that he could have said, and he made 13 cabinets and 14 tables, and you know, he was one really gung-ho carpenter working in his dad's shop. I mean, that would have satisfied our curiosity. Or he was a young, you know, he was studying to be a rabbi in the temple, and he was extremely good. He memorized this, and he memorized that, and he was a brilliant student. I mean, what do you want to talk about it? You know, if he was really brilliant, he, you know, he actually had liftoff from his initial encounter with the rabbis as a youth, then, you know, show off. Tell what a brilliant student he was. And then he left the rabbinical school, and then he went off and sought out, you know, went out to the desert, and then he saw John the Baptist, and, you know, tell the whole story. The fact that there's nothing there is just flat out odd, especially odd considering this is smack dab in the middle of the Jewish tradition. So it does raise some suspicion. What are you hiding? You know, at least just tell us an ordinary story like he was a good carpenter, but something for heaven's sakes, but to leave it completely blank, it does at least raise the suspicion who erased, who got out their black pen and just put through, because it did not conform to how they wanted to present Jesus as being born the Son of God, not evolving, not learning anything, not certainly not learning anything outside the Jewish domain. That would not go over well. And so there would be, if we're approaching this like a Sherlock Holmes, there was opportunity, there was motive, you know, and there's circumstantial evidence. But can we convict the writers, the compilers of the New Testament, compiled by the 5th century, I think it was, can we convict them of actually a real conspiracy, a cover-up job, and then fill it in with the story of his heading off to Asia? It's circumstantial evidence, not really compelling. And so there it is, it remains a question mark. Yeah, an interesting one.
I'll send you a copy of the book if I get a hold of one from Ladakh. Okie
dokie. Yeah, if you send me the original Tibetan, I'll be really happy. Well, Ladakhi, they write in the same script as the Tibetans, yeah. Maybe, was there a final question, or we'll call it a night?
Let's see. You were speaking about Galileo and the kind of abrupt stop of inquiry into medieval scholasticism, mm-hmm. and then Galileo basically, with this new tool, being able to see, mm-hmm. in a sense, reflecting on possibly just the advent of the written word, and also movable type, mm-hmm. Changed not only the way we communicated amongst the masses. Before, mm-hmm. communication actually was very sequestered, especially in the
sure.
medieval days, so
sure.
information wasn't available, so you never asked.
That's right.
Also, the advent of written word maybe in years before.
Centuries. The written word had been around for centuries. I mean, there was Latin before that, there was Greek,
right.
and so forth and
but
so on.
But written word.
Yeah, but the movable type, Gutenberg and the press and all of that, that comes around the same time. The fact that during the time of Luther, they had the Bible for the first time in a language that ordinary people could read, German. Until then, it was only for the elite, and the priest did not encourage the laity to read the Bible. It was rather taboo to read the Bible. They were the sole custodians of it. And the laity would get it only by way of the priest who could read it, but everybody else was out. And along comes translations into vernacular and printable and movable type. And then Galileo, very importantly, writing in Italian and not in Latin. Now, Latin, all the educated people could understand, but he wanted his word to get out to the common people because he knew he'd get a lot of flack, at least potential flack from the church, which eventually imprisoned him, of course, but also flack from the universities. And their lingua franca, of course, was Latin. So he just wanted to, you know, sidestep them and go right to the populace, which he did, but he pissed off a lot of people in the process.
And what do you think the kind of your vision is? Our communication changes. We have internet, proposal that we're using both sides of our brains because there's visual and text. Mm-hmm. And the way our communication is moving faster, in the contemplative sense, mm-hmm. how our experiences can be communicated even bigger.
It's a very interesting parallel, one I've never thought of before. That is, you're putting pieces together that I've never actually put in the same container at the same time. Your emphasis on movable type is absolutely crucial, because until then, you can imagine, every single book, somebody had to write out by hand incredibly time-consuming and expensive, you know. So this means the masses are just not going to get the written word. And then suddenly, that was the internet of their time, the movable print. That was it. You could buy a book cheaply because it just, you know, grind it out, print it out. And so that I already knew, but then to draw this very interesting parallel, I mean, you know, just with wireless internet, I mean, this is the closest to omniscience most of us are going to get to. You know, just go onto your Google, thank you, Lord, the prophet Google, and, you know, and thus spake the internet. You know, I mean, it's absolutely without precedent, you know. And so not only access to information, but then how many blogs are there by now? You know, and websites and so forth proliferating like nothing else. Everything has to be modeled after the proliferation of the internet. An unprecedented access to information and the sharing of information, share of insights. That is just the medium is absolutely revolutionary and unprecedented. And I would be scared to death if I were running any kind of totalitarian government and trying to clamp down on information. I mean, what a losing battle. I don't care whether it's China or any other totalitarian country or government. What a losing battle. It'd be just paranoid if I were trying to do such a thing. So I think this will be very interesting. And this certainly allows for something that's unprecedented, and that is not only a lot of good translations coming up, especially over the last 50 years from the Muslim tradition, from Rumi to the Vedanta tradition, the Buddhist, the Taoist, the early Christian. I mean, such a wealth of information you can get in the library, but nowadays, you know, on the internet, so much you can get just by, you know, tapping it into Google or whatever search machine you wish to use. So again, poised maybe for a revolution just by way of the media, let alone the message. A very, very fascinating interface between the two. Interesting insight, really interesting. Thank you for that. Yeah. Lasso, I hope this is of some value. I've certainly enjoyed myself, and I wish you all a good night.